And good afternoon, everybody. As you heard yesterday in the opening session, applied linguistics is one of the core areas of research in our university. We are therefore particularly pleased to have Professor Claire Krams as one of the keynote speakers in this conference. Throughout her career, she has played a pivotal role in developing the field. She has, for example, opened our eyes to the importance of context and culture in language learning, to matters of identity and subjectivity in learning, to ecological and cross-cultural perspectives on language learning, and to challenges of multilingualism. All of these being very essential perspectives, also when considering language learning in technological environments and contexts. Professor Krams is originally from France, but has made her career in the U.S. She first taught German at MIT for over 20 years, and since the early 90s has worked at the University of California in Berkeley as professor of German and affiliate professor of education and as the founding director of the Berkeley Language Center. She's currently retired from German department but holds an appointment as professor of the graduate school. Professor Krams has published widely on the topics I just mentioned, both in leading journals and through several highly acclaimed books such as The Multilingual Subject from 2009 and Language and Culture from 1998, just to give you a couple of examples. Her work is highly valued internationally, which shows in the many awards and prizes she has received during her career for excellence in research and teaching and for service in various academic organizations. I said earlier that we are happy to have Professor Krams here as for her renowned expertise in applied linguistics, but we are also very happy to welcome back to UVascular as a long-term collaborator with our research community. And actually, yesterday she mentioned to me when we were having lunch that in the 1970s, UVascular, and in particular former professor Kari Sajavaara, in fact has played a role in her choosing a career path in applied linguistics. In the welcoming text of the conference brochure, Miriam and Peppi write about the need to redefine the purpose and mission of the use of technology and language learning so that, and I quote, "the human factor continues to inform what we do and that technology expands and not limits our ways of communicating and engaging with each other across geographical distance and economic and cultural boundaries," end of quote. Given her broad expertise and vision, I can think of no better person to address these issues than Professor Krams, and look forward to hearing her insights on teaching foreign languages in the digital age. So please join me in welcoming Claire to the podium.
Okay, thank you very much, Talia. And thank you, Miriam and Beppi, for inviting me to back to UVascular and to speak here at EuroCal. I must admit that when Peppi asked me to be a keynote speaker here at EuroCal, I was petrified. I am not a tech person, and I know very little except that I use technology, of course, like we all do every day, but I am really not a specialist, and speaking to an audience of specialists absolutely terrified me. But she said, "You have been the president of ILA, and you are an applied linguist, and we would like you to take the perspective of an applied linguist." So I thought hard, and I said, well, okay, as long as I don't raise undue expectations, I will gladly say what I feel are burning issues about the role of technology in applied linguistics. And I thought to myself, after all, after having taught for 25 years at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, maybe I am a little legitimate in talking to you about teaching foreign languages in the age of information. And what I will do in my 45 minutes, I hope that we have time for questions and answers afterwards, I'm going to reflect with you a little bit on the C in C-A-L-L, the C that stands for computer, and the first L that stands for language. And these are going to be the two perspectives I'm going to take because I am very concerned that the computer is not only assisting language learning, it is transforming the L that we call language. Language is no longer what it used to be when it was not associated with the C of computer. And I want to talk about that because I am an applied linguist that is concerned about the application of linguistics and other fields for the solving of real-world problems, which is, among others, the teaching and learning of foreign languages. Now, I did not know that the color of this conference was orange. And I have just been explained that the color orange signifies the fire that you light under the knowledge that you transfer to students. So my first slide is going to be this. Now, this is the logo of a company called, in my country, Orange. And this is how the French publicize the qualities and the benefits of using the telecommunication giant Orange for your communications. As you can see, the legend behind beneath that picture is Orange vous rapproche, le reste vous appartient, which in English means Orange brings you closer together, the rest is in your hands. My talk is going to be about what is in your hands. What is the rest that we human beings have to do once the technology Orange has linked us together? As you can see from this picture, you have on the left-hand side a good-looking guy holding an orange cable that links him to an obviously African-looking woman. We read generally from left to right. So guess in which direction the technology goes. So the question and the challenge of CUL, I would submit, is what are they going to be talking about once they are linked with Orange? What are they going to remain silent about? Which language are they going to use when they talk with one another? Which other language, sign language, gestures, facial language, and what are they going to learn from one another once they are linked with Orange? And that I find interesting because, I mean, after all, the colonists, the colonizers, and the colonized. The colonizers on the left-hand side and the colonized on the right-hand side have not waited for Orange to talk to one another. So my question is, what role does Orange play in that communication that they are now having online, and what are they talking about? So the challenge of CUL today is to find out what people allow themselves to say to one another, why do they talk to one another, what do they find out when they talk to one another over online communications. And what kind of talk master is Orange? Is it only a cable, or does the cable influence the messages that are communicated across that line? So here is my outline. I'm going to be talking about what Mark Poster calls the mode of information, and that is the mode in which we are operating. I will, in two and three, I will remind us how language learning used to be before the advent of the computer, and in many and most language teaching classes today, on what principles is language teaching built. then how digital media have changed the nature of language learning and language use. Then in four, I will tell you a story. I will tell you the story. I won't leave the cat out of the bag, but I hope you'll enjoy that story about how Cal brings us closer and the rest is in our hands. And then my last section will be call for political action, because I do think that we are now in a political mode of information, and that is how I see the future and the role of Cal. So here is Mark Poster in his book, The Mode of Information, Poststructuralism and Social Context, already published in 1990, at a time where people were still reflecting on the role of the computer and the kind of knowledge that the computer produces in our lives. Right now, already 20, 30 years later, we are so used to the computer in our lives that we don't even think of asking these questions. But in 1990, the beginning of the internet, remember the internet dates of 1985, 1986, it was still the time where people were asking fundamental epistemological questions about all this knowledge. Here we have Mark Poster using the term the mode of information. What he was referring to, for those of you who have read Karl Marx, he was referring to, we are no longer in the mode of production, industrial production, but we are in a mode of communication and the exchange of communications, in fact, of information across these fiber optic cables. And this is what he writes. Electronic communications simply increase the representational power of language by reducing the temporal and spatial distancing of meaning. And that is what orange means when they bring us together. But what is the cost? What do we pay for that? However, the representational character of language is especially fragile and problematic. Why? Because in sphere after sphere of daily life, the relation of word and thing is complicated by the loss of the referent. What does it mean? What does he mean by the loss of the referent? The referent is what you find in the dictionary. It's the dictionary meaning of words. But it is also a meaning in a context. A word in the dictionary doesn't mean anything. It only means when you link it up to a text or you link it up to a context. What Mark Poster here is telling us is that we are closer with words, but that words have lost the relationship to their original context because we have reduced the distance and the time. On the screens, we see decontextualized words, and therefore those words have become particularly vulnerable to manipulation, to propaganda, to ideology, because they have lost their relationship to the living context which gave them birth. So today, when you read journals in applied linguistics, seeing language learning, applied linguistics, the language of applied linguistics in the professional world. Articles like McNamara or books like Blommert 2005 or Alistair Pennycook, they talk about post-structuralist views, post-modern views, post-humanist views even of what meaning is. They will tell you that meanings are polyvalent, you are uncertain, undetermined, that meanings always change and are not to be fixed. This is your post-structuralist view of meaning. But that's not what you find in language classrooms when you go. We still teach adjectives and prepositions and nouns and dictionary meanings. And the students still believe that if they learn all the vocabulary and all the grammar rules, they go to the country and they will be accepted. as justified and legitimate speakers of the language. Whoops! Big disappointment. Their skin is not the right color. Their eyes are not blue and blonde. As Donald Trump said, those immigrants that come to our country, they don't come from Sweden, do they? Now, what did he mean by that? He didn't mean the dictionary definition of Sweden. He meant they're not blue-eyed and blonde. They must be Arabs. They must come from the Middle East. Now, this is the reality of the speaking of English in everyday life. So what we look at, we're having here the computer, and it's good to remind ourselves that the computer does provide knowledge, but in a different way than books of philosophy or treatises that we usually associated with the teaching of foreign languages. The computer is primarily a problem-solving tool. So when we talk about problem-solving through foreign languages, we are already using foreign languages for their exchange value. We use foreign languages as a tool to discover something else, or to provide information, or to solve problems in the real world. We do not use language to enjoy poems, or to read maxims, or to understand philosophy, or deeper theological truths, as was the case in the last century. We are using foreign languages now to solve problems of communication. And that is quite a different view of seeing language and the role that language plays. So the computer is best at problem solving, information exchanging, and not as a hermeneutic, namely interpretive, approach to truth. I learned German in the 1950s, far before there were any computers. And considering the state of Germany in the 1950s, my purpose was not to learn German, to go and talk with Germans in Germany, as you can imagine. Thank God I learned German in order to read the German philosophers, German poets, and German novelists, yes, but not to communicate across borders. Thank God things have become different. But just to show you that language, you used to learn languages for different purposes 50 years ago. From an unlimited database in the 50s, the computer has become networked computers, global networks now in the 80s. So we have to remind ourselves of that different kind of landscape. You must know, and you surely know, that Google is now developing algorithms for the total translatability of languages. This is amazing. There will be no more untranslatable features of languages because of their cultural or their historical use. So this is the what is going on right now with the search engines that are, in fact, supplanting the need for more local, contextualized cultures. The internet, of course, provides wonderful digital sociocultural environments that offer, however, a self-sufficient context for language learning and teaching. Less and less of our language learners in the US want to go abroad. They have it all on the computer. All they go is in the internet. In fact, they have so internalized the landscapes of the internet, when they go to the country, they find the internet in the country. They feel that the country is a pale reflection of the beautiful colors that you can see on the internet. So why spend all that money and then go to the country? And again, foreign languages are seen by many, many students just for their exchange value and not for their usage value. The difference between usage and exchange is nicely captured by the work of Henri Lefebvre in France, but also has been captured by somebody, for instance, like Monica Heller and Alexandre Duchesne in Canada, who write about that distinction between usage and exchange. So the very nature of language has changed through the information revolution. Because now we tend to associate with language and language use what the computer does with language and language use, language very often in the public imagination is reduced to a mere code. Like Fortran, like Lisp, like all these computer languages, French, German, and Finnish are just codes. And you learn the code, the tool, and then you put it into a context. Knowledge is reduced to information, and a lot of the discourse, ambient discourse, talks about knowledge as information, not as wisdom or as insights. It's bits of information. Ideas are replaced by data. We have spoken and written language that is replaced by multimodal language. Language is only the language as we know it. The verbal language is only one way of semiosis, of making meaning. Speakers and writers are now virtual interlocutors. And what we used to call the negotiation of meaning in the communicative approach of the 1970s has become, unfortunately for many people, just a posting of information. I post, you post, I post again, you post again. And that is what is meant very often by negotiation of information. It's the Facebook type of communication. And the computer seems to be competing with humans. Feelings now are emojis. You used to have feelings, now you have emojis. Context becomes the text, and communicating becomes texting. So as you can see, the computer is not just helping you communicate, it is already redefining what it means. The combination of tech, media industry, big business, and politics is changing the way we view language and language use. So in the private sphere, global reachability does not mean greater understanding. See a lot of the emails, misunderstandings, and I'm sure you, like I, have lots of examples of such misunderstandings, including in family reunions. I've just come from a big family. I'm a large family in Paris. It's not because we've been online since the last 2 or 3 years that we understand each other better. We all speak English now, and that's even worse. Because we think we understand one another, and we don't. And that is the problem of multilingual families who have this English language and who understand each other even worse than when they had to translate between each other. In the public sphere, you know what Trump is doing right now with language. Truth, post-truth, alternative facts, the idea that you can say something and the referent is God knows where, and you say the next day, you say the contrary of what you said the day before, and it's all impression management. Okay. I'm going to just skip the last one because I don't want to dwell too much. Oh, gosh. Yes. Wow, you've made his hair look better than it ever has. Okay, so let me recapitulate a little bit where we used to be in terms of language learning and teaching. And I'm just going to read them because we know all this, but it's good to be reminded. Despite all the calls for post-structural and subjectivizing language and all the names that I have listed here, language teachers still teach the forms of the language, the adjectives, the prepositions, and the past participles, and then put them into communicative activities where they're supposed to be contextualized. Their way of dealing with it, with this is based on 10 structuralist beliefs that I'm just trying to list. Referentiality is primordial in language learning and teaching. You do teach dictionary definitions. You learn still lists of vocabulary. You say what you mean and you mean what you say. That is part of the language learning experience. When you speak, you do speak the way you have been socialized in a particular cultural environment. Someone does expect some pragmatics that are going to be different in different languages. And certainly, if you become communicatively competent in the language, you will be successful. That is part of why people learn English in particular, but also other foreign languages. Intercultural communicative competence will enable you to communicate successfully across national cultures. I'm quoting Barham here. Motivation needs to be an investment. I'm quoting Bonnie Norton. A good accent might be good for comprehensibility and will allow you to make it easier to negotiate a favorable social identity. If you believe Kanagaraja, you need to negotiate values. I've always wondered how you can negotiate moral values. I thought that moral values was something that does not get negotiated. But apparently in a neoliberal economy, you do negotiate moral values, even religious values, I suppose. And certainly my number 10, despite what Ben Rampton has told me again and again, what can't be tested, measured, and evaluated is not worth teaching. And you will hear that from all the teachers I talk to. You do not teach it because you cannot test it. And there are many different debates in applied linguistics about that. But these are the institutional constraints of teachers, and they know which way their bread is buttered. What things have become is in fact a change in scale. The computer has changed the scale of communication, and there are many people, including Blumert, who will tell you change the scale and you change the message. It is no longer the same message that you receive and that you send when you change the scale and the speed and the volume of communication. The spatial context is all. Because we are, the computer spatializes our world. We forget, in fact, that our world is very much dependent on time and the time it takes to make meaning, etc. We have, in fact, there's a special issue of the journal Applied Linguistics on transspatiality, that our relationships are so commanded by the space on the screen and the imagined spaces that we bridge through online communication that we tend to think of movement across space, rapidity of online exchanges. Our students are impatient. They do not think in terms of time. They want everything immediately, quick, and particularly speedy. So that has changed again. We have the notion of hyper-reality, of reality. Our president here of the United States, as you know, Donald Trump, is not only our president, but he is also an actor in reality TV, which explains why we are in the right now so disoriented in when you watch the news in the United States, because you don't know, is he now a businessman? Is he now the president? Is he now just an actor on Fox News? So you never know what is entertainment, what is politics, what is business, and this mixing of genre creates a hyper-reality. Remember the two meetings that he had in June and July, the spectacle meeting between Trump and Kim Jong-un in Singapore that was just for the show, and the meeting that he held here in Finland with Trump in July and 18 that was, as they were saying, the deliberately empty gesture. So we are in a times where language doesn't mean what it says, that meetings do not have the same meaning as what they seem, and we are in a kind of what Baudrillard has called hyper-reality. In addition, language has put enormous amount of importance given to the emotional impact, and that's what you feel constantly on the news in particular, and politicians as well. You know the difference between illocutionary intentions and perlocutionary effects. Impression management has become much more important than it used to be, and that power tends to want to remain invisible, which is why we have such difficulty with, in particular, pronouncements by Trump, where we don't know what he intended to mean. We know what the effect has been, but we don't know. He remains impervious to any questions about what was his illocutionary intent. Right now, in applied linguistics, for instance, a group like the Douglas Fir group puts in question, in fact, the value of culture in communication, because in a global economy, we are supposed to be free-floating individuals taking responsibility for our words, independent of the culture that we come from. I will just finish this list of, there are 10 of them. I'm coming here to a phenomenon that I recommend. Bernard Harcourt has written on the kind of identities that we put forth on Facebook, and that is an expository kind of identity where we take pleasure in exposing ourselves, which has the results of some students of mine coming into my office and saying, "Professor Crumbs, I don't know who I am." And I say, "What do you mean?" And they say, "Well, I'm on Facebook, but I can't dissociate the perception that others have of me on Facebook and how I see myself." So I say, "Well, do you write a diary?" I'm so old-fashioned that I still write a diary. And so I say, "Do you write a diary?" "Oh, yes, I do," she says. And she adds, "And I send it to my mother every night." I said, "You write a diary and you send it to your mother?" "Oh, yeah, and to my friends also." I said, "And then I incorporate their feedback into my next diary entry the next day." And I say, "Well, kiddo, no wonder you have an identity problem." But that is the expository identity that Harcourt talks about. Now, there's a legitimacy when you don't look Chinese, but you've got a PhD in Chinese language and literature, but you look Irish. Will you get a job in an East Asian department? No way. Why do you think I am legitimate as a teacher of German? My name is not Kramsch. It's my married name. That gives me the legitimacy in the US to teach German. And my looks happen to match the language that I teach. That's a bit of luck. But if I had married a Chinese, okay, do you know now how people sell English nowadays in the world? Read the DaCosta, Park and We 2016, where they show that in Singapore, you sell English no longer for its economic value, but for its moral value. Children are taught that they have to exploit their human capital, and therefore they have to learn English, because it's exploiting your human and cultural capital. Now, this is interesting, the notion of linguistic entrepreneurship. is making waves in the world. And then finally, beyond politics. David Gramlin, in an article that he's written a book on monolingualism, he writes, "Of course, conferences on applied linguistics and foreign language teaching are no less than teeming with exciting research about technology. Technology-enhanced language learning, complexity, computer-aided language learning, digital literacies, corpus-based language learning, telecollaboration, and the like. These booming arenas of technological innovation are, however, focused primarily on the application of emergent technologies, rather," he says, "than on the implications." And he feels that we should spend more time thinking of the implications of computer technology on language learning, and not only on the applications. Okay. Let me get now to what is in our hands. We had the orange line. What is in our hands? And I want to tell you now a story that was told by Toni Morrison, the Nobel Prize writer. In her Nobel lecture in 1993, she tells of an old woman, wise and blind, who is visited one day by some young people who seem to be bent on showing her up for the fraud that she believes she is. They stand before her, and one of them says, "Old woman, I hold in my hand a bird. Tell me whether it is living or dead." And the woman responds, "I don't know. I don't know whether the bird you hold in your hand is dead or alive, but what I do know is that it is in your hands. It is in your hands." Meaning, if it is dead, you have killed it. And if it's alive, you can still let it free. Now, Morrison interprets that parable as being about language. And she ends that part and she says, she uses language as a bridge to her young visitors, and using her authority as a wise and old storyteller, she teaches them a lesson, how language has been used and abused over the ages to support crime and discrimination, injustice and tyranny, hypocrisy and political correctness. And she enjoins them to take responsibility for their words. And she concludes with the words that you have up there. "We die. That may be the meaning of life. But we do language. That may be the measure of our lives." That's half the story. At this point in the story, the old woman's words make the children angry. And they start telling another story that I want to tell you now. What the children hear the old woman saying is that the adult world has been an utter failure. Language has been abused by propaganda and lies and all kinds of bad things. And what they hear is that the old woman is only pontificating, teaching them a lesson. And that makes them angry. So after a while, they invent another story. And the story goes like this. They stand there. Suppose nothing was in their hands. Suppose the visit was only a ruse, a trick, to get her to speak to them, taken seriously as they have never been before, a chance to interrupt, to violate the adult world, its miasma of discourse about them, for them, but never to them. Urgent questions are at stake, including the one they have asked. Is the bird we are holding living or dead? Perhaps the question meant, could someone tell us what is life? What is death? And if the old and the wise one, who have lived life and faced death, cannot describe either, who can? Is there no speech, they ask her, no words you can give us that helps us break through your dossier of failures? We have no bird in our hands, living or dead. We have only you and our important question. Don't you remember being young, when language was magic without meaning? When what you could say, you could not mean? When the invisible was what imagination strove to see? When questions and demands for answers burned so brightly, you trembled with fury at not knowing? Why didn't you reach out? Touch us with your soft fingers. Delay the sound bite, the lesson, until you knew who we were. We were young. We are young, unripe. We have heard all our short lives that we have to be responsible. What could that possibly mean in the catastrophe that world has become? Is there no context for our lives? No song, no literature, no poem full of vitamins? No history connected to experience that you can pass along to help us that strong? Think of our lives and tell us your particularized world. Tell us what the world has been to you in the dark places and in the light. Don't tell us what to believe, what to fear. Show us the belief's wide skirt and the stitch that unravels fear's call. You, old woman, blessed with blindness, can speak the language that tells us only what language can. How to see without pictures. Language alone protects us from the scariness of things with no names. Tell us what it is to be a woman, so that we may know what it is to be a man. What moves at the margins. What it is to have no home in this place, to be set adrift from the one you knew, what it is to live at the edge of towns that cannot bear your company. And she goes on like that, and of course you think of Toni Morrison, the daughter of slaves, and the from a family of black American slaves. So we could ask ourselves, what could the questions of foreign language learners possibly be in this new digital age of Facebook and Google, not Google? Let's imagine what our students might say. Orange tells us, Orange brings you closer to what matters most to you. But it's up to you, and that's what it says on the publicity. It's up to you to decide what's essential. That's part of the publicity. But they might say, we are young, inexperienced. What if we don't know what could matter most to us? What is essential? What if we don't know who we are, except for the face that we project on Facebook? What if we are afraid of missing out on what all the others seem to know? Afraid of being left out of a game that we don't even know? Describe to us, our students might tell us, describe to us why you became a language teacher, what that language has meant to you, what it means to be multilingual, to be at home everywhere and nowhere. Show us how you have found a place between your languages and what it has meant to you to emigrate and to build a home in a new country. Show us what it is to be a native speaker so that we may know what it is to be a language learner and a foreigner. Tell us why it is important to learn another language. Isn't the language we grew up good enough? And why this particular language? What does this language mean to those who speak it from birth? Tell us the dark sides of the language. What has it been used for throughout its history? Against whom and against what? Tell us the bright sides of the language, its poems, its songs, its literature. Recite to us your favorite poem. Recount for us your most memorable experience. So I come to my last section called Call for Political Action. Bruno Latour, the philosopher of science, just published a little book called Où atterrir? Comment s'orienter en politique? the French has a play on words on the word atterrir, which means to land on earth. How to orient yourself in politics. And he reflects on the pervading sense of powerlessness in our times of ecological devastations, globalization, and nationalism. And he proposes that, like in pre-revolutionary times in France, where the king had sent out an invitation across the land for complaints, condoléances, les cahiers de doléances, to ask the peasants, the workers, the farmers, for their wishes, their dreams, their complaints. He suggests that we do that with our students, with our constituents, along the following lines. We ask them, what is essential to you? What do you hold most dear? What do you depend on for your subsistence? One could say sustainability, almost. And for young people learning foreign languages, we could add, what do you dream of becoming? Why are you learning this particular language? What do you like or you hate about that language, about the people who speak it? What do you want to do with that language? And particularly something that is never asked is, what do you wish to escape? Which language are you dreaming of escaping, even your mother tongue? To answer these questions honestly, you need language, precise language, nuanced language, both literal and figurative language, poems and prose, facts and fiction. Such a use of language, I will argue, is political. Not in the sense of la politique, which is the party political struggles that we see on television, but in the sense of the French le politique, which is a political act in the larger sense of a symbolic power games that are inherent in differences in perspective, conflicts of interests, ethical dilemmas, and paradoxes. And in that sense, language teaching is always a political endeavor. And finally, Call can raise political awareness, a meta-awareness of what it means to communicate via a computer, through precise documentation of the concrete differences and misunderstandings in daily life among people who are, through Orange or other telecommunication companies, brought together closer but also increasingly divided by computer technology. So Call, in my view, has a political role to play in helping young language learners position themselves politically in our political times. And upon this, I will stop. Thank you very much for listening.
you. Thank you very much for very inspiring and thought-provoking talk. We really enjoyed it. I think given the time, we will continue talking over the coffee. Okay. Have quick questions to you over there. Okay. And don't forget the invitation to the group photograph. But before that, I would like to extend this small present as a token for appreciation for your contribution to the conference.